It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Constitutional crisis. That's a phrase we've heard a great deal in the news over the past few days. This hour, we want to tackle that question through a historical lens. What constitutes a constitutional crisis? What are times in U.S. history when we have experienced that? Joining us to give us the long view, the very long view back in U.S. history, presidential historian Tim Walsh. He is the retired director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum. Welcome back to our studio, Tim.
Thanks, Ben. Good to be here.
What does it mean? Let's start off by talking a little bit about what that phrase means and then go on to see instances where a constitutional crisis has challenged this country, and then perhaps at the end look at the present times to see how it measures up. What does it mean to have a constitutional crisis? What has to happen?
Well, a constitutional crisis often emerges as a result of a lack of specificity in the documents that are governing our nation. So in our case, of course, when we say constitution, we mean the constitution that was written in 1787 or the documents and guidance that we had before that. And it's usually a point of friction between different branches within, say, the federal level after the constitution was written. Of course, we had an executive, a legislative, and a judicial, and the relationship between the three, conflict between a president and a Congress or between the president and the courts, it can be a crisis. But it also can be friction between the federal government and the state governments. Do the states have rights to leave the Union, for example, which was the nullification crisis of 1832, South Carolina refused to collect tariffs on behalf of the federal government. They refused to cooperate. And then, of course, the Civil War, when close to a dozen different states chose to say, we no longer wish to be part of this nation. So that's the two types of crises that we face. And there have been throughout our history a smattering of lesser or greater conflicts. It seems that in each century, we've had one major crisis. So in the 18th century, it's the Constitution itself. We rejected we found the Articles of Confederation dysfunctional. We had to come up with a new form of government, which is what we have today. And then, of course, in the 19th century, it's that question of states' rights versus federal rights, which leads to the Civil War. Of course, slavery is involved in that, the issue of slavery as well. And then in the 20th century, it's the whole question of our economic future, the Great Depression, and how the federal government is going to stimulate the economy. You know, President Trump talks about priming the pump. Well, that was the ultimate effort to prime the pump and get our economy back together. So those are three big crises.
Mm-hmm. And then last in the 1970s, we want to also talk about the Watergate crisis. But let's go back to the era of our founding fathers. You mentioned 1787. Right. What in particular didn't work about the Constitution before the one formed, written in 1787?
Very few people remember the Articles of Confederation. 1781 to 1789, this was the document that governed our nation. Essentially, it treated every state as equal. So each state had one vote in the legislature. We had a very weak executive. And basically, states were allowed to define their relationship with other states. So they might refuse each other's currency. They might refuse taxes and so forth. And it was too dysfunctional. You couldn't have a national economy with this very loose confederation.
And everybody recognized it needed to be more centralized.
Certainly,
more federalized.
The major figures within the country, and there were those who were suspicious of centralized power, who did not believe in a stronger constitution, but led by people like James Madison and Alexander Hamilton and others, they agreed, that is the states all agreed that they would get together in Philadelphia in the summer of 1787 and amend or repair the Articles of Confederation. The intent was not to write up a new document, a new constitution, but that is what resulted in that summer, that hot summer in Philadelphia, 1787, in Independence Hall, window shut, they're wearing wool. It's amazing that these 55 delegates could come together. And of course, there was the Virginia Plan, that was James Madison. All representation in Congress would be determined by population. There was the New Jersey Plan. No, we're going to go back to what the Articles of Confederation said, one vote for each state. And then there's the Connecticut Compromise. Two houses of a legislature, one based on the states themselves, We now have two senators for each state and one based on population, the House of Representatives, along with an executive.
And then we decided that the executive needed to be more powerful.
Right, exactly. A strong executive, and that emerges out of debate, discussion, and compromise. So you have, by 1787, by September 17th, when the document is signed, a compromise that then is put to the people to be ratified to the states. It's ratified by the state legislatures, and so in 1789, we have George Washington as our first president. We were blessed, too, to have Washington as the president of the Constitutional Convention. People came to trust Washington and see him, and his validation was important to the whole process. But that was a crisis. You couldn't have said in 1785, I can see the future of the country. One peculiar story about the document itself. We had such little faith in the Constitution after it was ratified that it was just stored in a case in a drawer. No one thought that this wasn't going to be amended or changed. It was the Declaration of Independence that we were so proud of. So we put it up on the wall in the government office where the sun bleached it. You can barely read the Declaration of Independence, but if you go to the National Archives, you can read the Constitution as clearly because we had so little belief that that was going to be the final form of government. So we were born, to some extent, in constitutional crisis.
Okay, let's move on through U.S. history a little bit further.
I just want to mention Marbury versus Madison because it's a very quiet crisis. This is 1803. The question, how do we resolve differences between the issues within the executive branch? Often these are sent to the legislative branch. It's sent to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court asserted in 1803 the right of judicial review. So if there's disagreements between the two other branches, between the legislative and the executive, the Supreme Court will reside. So that was a resolution of a small conflict at the time that has had powerful importance going forward. The next after that, the nullification crisis, South Carolina in 1832 said, we don't want to collect these tariffs, these federal tariffs. We reject them. Andrew Jackson said, whoa, no, you're not. We will use force if necessary to force South Carolina to pay these taxes, these tariffs. And in effect, eventually this is resolved in the Congress by revising the tariffs. South Carolina backed off, agreed to pay the tariffs. Andrew Jackson said, okay, we won't send force. But it was a glimmer, a hint that further crisis was going to come between the states and the federal government. And, of course, that's what the Civil War is. Mm-hmm. Can the states leave the Union? As I said before, one of the great quotes comes from Shelby Foote. I'm not sure where he got it. And that is, the Civil War resolved how we were going to see ourselves. Before the Civil War, we used to say the United States are, that is, a collection of states. The United States are, after the Civil War, the United States is. We were one nation, as we say in the Pledge of Allegiance. One nation. We were not seeing ourselves as one nation before the Civil War. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, the Civil War resolves that question of, and that conflict over how we're going to see ourselves as a nation, how we're going to relate to one another, and how the federal government is supreme over the states. So anyway, go ahead.
Tim Walsh is with us, presidential historian. It seems to me, based on what you've said, and we're talking about constitutional crises in U.S. history this hour, since constitutional crisis is something that has popped up in our news, is what we're experiencing now a constitutional crisis? That was a headline I saw the other day. Mm-hmm. But it seems, based on what you've said here, there are constitutional crises of a minor and a major category. When we talk about the Civil War, people living at that time, my guess is, even President Lincoln would not have known if the Union was going to survive.
Correct. Absolutely. And when you're in the middle of a crisis or you're in the real time of events, you can't quite determine how important this is going to be. And you do need the value of time and distance from an event to let you measure how important that is. So we can't look at the present day and say, oh, this is an unprecedented crisis. No, we won't know perhaps for 50 or 75 years, maybe certainly a generation or more, and looking back on the Trump presidency and say, oh, this was a serious crisis or it was a minor
crisis. Why is that? That you can only see it in historical perspective. You can't recognize it at the moment because shouldn't there be a list of criteria like a recipe, this and this and this are present, therefore it is a constitutional crisis.
Unfortunately, history is it's not a science. You can't mix it together and get the same results with the same types of people. This is it's a form of argument and interpretation, and what we need is a sort of a leavening process, a sense of distance, because when we're living it, we are emotionally involved and engaged in it. So when those citizens in 1785 or 1787 knew there was going to be a convention, they were eager to find out what it was. And as they said to Ben Franklin at the time, Mr. Franklin, what type of government do we have? And he said, a republic, if you can keep it. And of course, that's always the challenge of the American government going forward, is to deal with these crises, to find a compromise. But when we're living it, it doesn't give us the maturity that we have from a distance.
Let's move on through history from the Civil War. Where do you want to pick up?
Well, I want to pick up after the Civil War. Of course, Andrew Johnson is president in 1868. He's a weak president. He succeeded the martyred Abraham Lincoln. He wants to replace his cabinet. The Congress says, no. Tenure of Office Act. You have to keep the cabinet that is there. Of course, that leads to Johnson's impeachment. He is not convicted. So in truth, it leads to a crisis that's resolved, frankly, by the Congress to absolve Johnson. It wasn't ultimately a major crisis, but it helped to define the presidency. And going forward after that, we have the election of 1876 very quickly as a crisis because we have no majority in the Electoral College. And in fact, Samuel Tilden, like Hillary Clinton, won the popular vote but lost the electoral vote. And so we have that crisis. And then going up to the incapacity of Woodrow Wilson in 1920. Wilson has a stroke. He's really incapable of leading the nation. But we don't have in the Constitution enough information to decide when a president should be declared incapable of leading the nation.
How big of a circle knew after this stroke in 1919 that his wife was and staff were handling the business of the nation?
Cary Grayson, his physician, and his wife essentially were the ones who controlled all access to the president. They would, the members of the cabinet, the vice president would check every day. They would have questions. Mrs. Wilson would go in and get an answer to the question. And there are those who suggest that Mrs. Wilson was actually acting as president of the United States. We now have the 25th Amendment. And, of course, later after that, we had Dwight Eisenhower had a heart attack and Ronald Reagan was shot. We needed to use the 25th Amendment to determine when a president of the United States is incapable of taking a charge of the office and turning the authority over to the vice president.
Mm-hmm. Okay. On from the 1920 to the Great
Depression.
Well,
the Great Depression, because it's a very different kind of constitutional crisis. Many people in 1932 felt that democracy couldn't survive. The economy had collapsed. The federal government seemed incapable of addressing the nation. We were not used to a federal government inserting themselves in local and state affairs. And so what you have with the Emergency Banking Act in 1933, shortly after Franklin Roosevelt is inaugurated and then going on with other New Deal legislation, you have the whole concept of entitlements and of regulation that means the federal government is going to take a more robust and direct role in the lives of average American citizens, and it's the social welfare safety net that we have today. Now, we're continuing to argue it over
exactly.
That in health care and in other kinds of aid and assistance programs, and how much can we pay for this and so forth. So those are the three major crises: the Constitutional Convention, the Civil War, and the Great Depression. And when you measure today's events in terms of those three major crises, this is pretty small potatoes. Yes, there's a lot of, as I say, bright, shiny objects, and you're turning in. It's almost like a radio or television melodrama. What will the president do today? But really, cooler heads will prevail, I like to say. And, of course, there may very well be people or events in the future that prove me wrong. But in truth, what we're saying is measure the events of today against those three major crises.
Democrats have leapt to the constitutional crisis in the 1970s, the Watergate crisis,
right,
when President Nixon, following a break-in at the Democratic National Committee headquarters, called the Watergate at the Watergate in 1972. He attempted a cover-up. The conspiracy was discovered. It was investigated by Congress. And so this led to a crisis. In what way was that a crisis? What was the form of that crisis?
Well, I think what you had is the belief, and before the tapes were discovered, the belief that the president may have been involved in a cover-up of a crime. And in that sense, the president had committed what would have been considered an impeachable offense. But the Congress wanted to move in a slow and deliberate fashion, so you have the Select Watergate Committee. You have the benefit of television and radio at the time, which essentially meant that the entire nation was present in those hearing rooms listening to the testimony. And then when, in effect, Alexander Butterfield had to admit, yes, there was a taping system, then we created a problem. The constitutional crisis was between the executive power of the president and his right to executive privilege and the right of Congress to investigate the president, and the fight over the access to the tapes, the special prosecutor, Archibald Cox, who goes to the Supreme Court to resolve it, with the president then firing him, the resignation of the attorney general. And so you can see that it becomes a great drama that unravels.
When we compare the present times with that times, we have to include the vastly different media environment in the 1970s.
Oh, goodness.
We had three networks, ABC, CBS.
And maybe a half
NBC,
a dozen major
PBS,
newspapers.
Right. And there was none of this sort of splintering off into how many different factions of where you receive your news.
We have too much news in a way. I mean, we say, well, we don't know what happened yesterday. I mean, that is, for example, what did the president say to the Russians? Well, it's classified. I mean, whatever he said probably shouldn't have been said, but we certainly don't have a right to know it. And there's so many different news outlets. It is, as they say, like drinking from a fire hose. I mean, you're just inundated with too much information, and it does give people a certain apprehension about the future. And so I think we become agitated because we're getting rumor and news and information all at the same time. In some ways, it's better if we have news given to us in a filtered fashion.
Finishing up our Constitution. Finishing up our conversation with presidential historian Tim Walch about constitutional crises in U.S. history. When we look at the big ones that you've listed off here, seven or eight of them, which of these do you think are most relevant for today? Which would you look to? I mean, is there a way you can get instruction, learn lessons from the past? Is that a useful exercise?
Certainly. In many ways, the whole question about investigating the Russian connection to the campaign, and the question is whether or not there was a crime. And I've not heard people feel that there was a crime, but there does seem to be something of a cover-up. And somebody said, whereas Watergate was a crime, in search of a cover-up, this is a cover-up in search of a crime. So, in effect, there isn't any real there, so to speak. So I'm concerned that what we're doing is we're spending an enormous amount of time trying to get the president to cooperate with the whole process and the legitimacy of the search for information. The Congress has a right to investigate what happened. The president should cooperate with it, because to the contrary then creates a constitutional crisis over which branch has right to what information.
Rather than call it a hoax.
Right, exactly.
And say it's a taxpayer-funded hoax.
If you're going to constantly be in a counter-punching mode, you're going to precipitate a larger crisis that had nothing underneath it. And so in that sense, I suppose relevance, Watergate certainly is relevant. I think the question of the capacity of the president to lead at any particular time, I mean, not suggesting that
Back to the Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, I think the whole question of temperament and the ability to go forward in leading a nation is to be determined collectively. I mean, we are the people. So in that sense.
So let's talk about the 25th Amendment there after Woodrow Wilson, the case after his stroke in 1919 that you described earlier. What does the 25th Amendment then prescribe? What is the mechanism for determining the competency of the president?
If a president were to have a medical emergency, he was shot in the case of Ronald Reagan, or had a heart attack in the case of—
And we have had times like that.
That's quite logical. We need to have a plan going forward. And so what happens is, if it's elective surgery or something like that, the president will turn over to the vice president the authority to lead the nation until such time the president can reclaim his right to office. And so in that sense, most presidents voluntarily make the transition, temporary transition to power. Now, if something were to happen to President Trump, then he would turn power over to the vice president.
What if a president, Trump or any other president, is unwilling to do that?
Unable.
Yeah, unwilling or unable. What are the outside ways in which
the outside ways are the members of his cabinet assemble and they vote, and the majority determines that the president is incapable of leading and power is turned over to the vice president. The president then can appeal this decision. I think it goes to the Supreme Court. I'd have to look at the language again. But it's a very messy process. We certainly don't want to go down that road if we don't have to.
Mm-hmm. When you look at these constitutional crises of the past in the U.S., and we look at the aftermath, we have just a couple minutes left here. But I wonder, because when we hear crises, we talk, damage is something. What kind of lasting damage do we come through these things stronger than before? Are we damaged? Have we taken a few steps back in the case of the Civil War, the nullification crisis, or the banking crisis? Do we have to regain ground again, or does it make it stronger?
One of the benefits of history is it tends to smooth over the rough edges of contemporary affairs. We tend to think that we're living in the most interesting, extraordinary, maybe even dystopian times. And so in that sense, the benefit of history is that when we get through it, we look back on it and we say, yeah, that was a rough patch, but we're more optimistic. And I do think that at the end we are a very optimistic, well-engaged people. Think for the fact that we are a nation of people who got into the hulls of leaky boats, who sailed across an ocean, walked across a country, didn't speak the language. Often things were hostile, weather and so forth, and yet we survived. We're the richest, really most blessed nation, on Earth, and it's a result of our fortitude and our ability to get through things and to compromise and find solutions. We will find a solution.
Mm-hmm. In 30 seconds, one pessimistic view that I heard is, well, yeah, but the nation now, we've never been here before where almost half the nation really dislikes the other half of the nation. Or is that a false characterization?
No. We've had elections like this, very close elections. Obviously, the election in 2000 was quite close between Gore and Bush. 1876 between Tilden and Hayes was a very close election in which Tilden got almost 51% of the vote. To Hayes's 48% of the vote, and yet Hayes, through a connection of a deal in Congress, was elected president. Jackson and Adams in 1824.
So your message, perhaps, let the process work.
Read history. And Ben Sasse's new book, Senator from Nebraska, about reengaging ourselves in civics and history will be helpful.
Wonderful. Thank you for this historical perspective. The former director of the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum, Tim Walsh, our presidential historian, we like to call on more often than we have in the past. Thank you very much for being there at a moment's notice, Tim Walsh.
Thanks for listening to me, Ben.
Coming up in just a moment, New York Times bestselling author Nathaniel Philbrick presents a controversial portrait of the American people in crisis during the Revolutionary War. Benedict Arnold. After this break, I'm Ben Kiefer. It's River to River. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. It's a time when the dysfunction of government drives citizens to despair, a time when self-serving politicians may destroy faith in the founding principles of our country. The time we want to recall this next half hour is not the present, as you may think. Let's go back to the American Revolution, when some of the same forces at work today were present and threatening to destroy American independence in its infancy. My guest this half hour is Nathaniel Philbrick, New York Times bestselling author of the National Book Award winner In the Heart of the Sea, as well as Mayflower. His latest book focuses on the middle years of the American Revolution and the tragic and often misunderstood relationship between George Washington and Benedict Arnold. The title of the book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Nathaniel Philbrick joins me by phone. Welcome to the program.
Well, it's great to be with you.
Let's have you set the scene at the start of your book in September of 1776, when the Continental Army has to evacuate New York after a devastating defeat. Tell us where we are at this point in the Revolutionary War.
Yeah, well, we've just had what's called the Siege of Boston that follows up Bunker Hill, which was it was a British victory, but it was actually a moral American victory, and the British were forced to evacuate from Boston. But the Empire strikes back. It sets its sights on New York, sends a huge armada of 400 ships, 40,000 soldiers and sailors. That's more people than all in Philadelphia, which was the largest city in North America at this point. And there's Washington with a small, underfunded army trying to defend New York and the high ground in Brooklyn. It is not his greatest hour as a general. He is humiliated, really, by William Howe in the Battle of Brooklyn. He's forced to retreat across the East River at night and then forced to retreat from New York to Harlem Heights and ultimately across the breadth of New Jersey to the other side of the Delaware River. And it's Washington at his absolute lowest. He's frustrated. He loses more than 75% of his army to desertion. It could not have gone worse. And this is where the book begins. And what's really terrible is by gaining New York, the British have gained access to the Hudson River, which extends straight north up to Albany, and then with a little jog to Lake Champlain, which is a river-like lake that extends more than 100 miles into Canada, the British have a toehold on this corridor of water that, if they can get control of it, will cut off New England from the rest of the colonies and will result in the America losing the revolution at its very beginning.
Mm-hmm. And you refer to Great Britain's forces as the Empire striking back, and it really, when you talk about this is the greatest power on earth at the time, the British naval forces, and the American forces were, compared to that, what? Did we have any navy?
We had a navy only in name, and it really wasn't even that. And, you know, there's one man that is really standing between America either continuing to go on and falling apart, and it's Benedict Arnold. He's stationed with a ragtag fleet of 15 boats that he has helped build that summer on Lake Champlain. These are basically overgrown rowboats with sails on them, equipped with cannons, and it's his job. He stationed his fleet in Valcour Island, just below what's now Plattsburgh, on the west bank of Lake Champlain, and it's his job to prevent a huge British armada that's coming down from Canada with schooners, a three-masted warship, you know, the state-of-the-art stuff, thousands of soldiers, gunboats, all this is coming down. And if they succeed in taking Fort Ticonderoga at the southern tip of Lake Champlain, then Albany, they will have done it. They will have secured that corridor of water, and it's game over for the United States. And it's Arnold's job to try to prevent that.
So what, what in fact happened then?
It's called the Battle of Valcour Island, the greatest sea battle most of us have never heard of, fought on a lake in fresh water. And what Arnold does is incredible. He draws the British into this small bay inside Valcour Island and is able to neutralize the largest of the British ships so that it turns into this gunfest between his 15 ships and about 20 British gunships. They blast away at each other, and Arnold is able to fight them to a draw as night comes. He escapes that night as they sail down towards Fort Ticonderoga. The next day the British catch up to him. He has his own kind of last stand where he fights them furiously as the rest of his fleet attempts to escape. There's so many cannonball and musket ball holes in his ship that he rams it into what's now the Vermont coast of Lake Champlain. The bay is still called Arnold Cove. And he flees and makes his way back to Fort Ticonderoga. The British go, "What the heck was that?" And they make their way down to Fort Ticonderoga, but they begin to look at the calendar. If we're going to encounter this kind of resistance, maybe we should delay this till next year. The lake is about to freeze, and Arnold succeeds in preventing the British from taking Fort Ticonderoga. They retreat back to Canada. And Arnold has done it. He has saved America in 1776 and cements his reputation as one of the great generals in the American Army.
Mm-hmm. I want to talk about Benedict Arnold's relationship with Washington, but before that, just generally in your research here, tell us what the sense is you got of Benedict Arnold as a military leader, obviously from your description there, daring, courageous. What kind of man was he? Charismatic?
Yeah. He was charismatic. He was passionate. If you were with Benedict Arnold in the midst of battle, you were in the presence of a true great battlefield commander. But, you know, with Arnold, it was a fine line between he loved risk. But was he taking risk to burnish his reputation as a swashbuckling hero, or was he really doing what was the right thing for his army? General Waterbury, who was his underling at the Battle of Valcour Island, could not believe the risks Arnold was willing to take and objected to them before and after the battle, and quite rightly. But the thing about Arnold is he would take these great risks, but they would work out. In the process, however, he did destroy his fleet. You know, only a few of the vessels survived the Battle of Valcour Island. But the fact is he did it. He delayed the British, not only taking Fort Ticonderoga, but he postponed what would become the Battle of Saratoga almost a year later. That would be the great victory. And it was all set up by Arnold at this stage. And so Arnold was a risk taker. He was passionate. And it worked well for him on the battlefield, but when he was off the battlefield, it was a different story.
Mm-hmm.
He was not a tactful man. He would often anger his fellow officers when not in a fighting situation, and he was terrible with politicians. He just had no patience for them and did not suffer fools gladly.
Let's talk a little bit about Benedict Arnold's relationship with General Washington, the commander of the Continental Army. They were on good terms at the start of the war and in the period that starts your book off, right?
Absolutely. Washington recognized very early on that this was a special officer. He sent Arnold on an amazing expedition through the interior of what's now modern Maine to attempt to take Quebec. It was unsuccessful, but it earned Arnold the reputation of the American Hannibal. Washington, I think, recognized that he needed more Arnolds in his army. And I think there's probably a little bit of almost envy because, you know, Washington was saddled with the crushing weight of command. If he had been 10 years younger, he could have been an Arnold out there on the battlefield winning those battles. But so he had immense respect for Arnold and would, throughout the early years of his career, do everything he could to further Arnold. Even at one point, soon after the Battle of Valcour Island, Washington, after all the setbacks he suffered in New York and New Jersey, has the greatest comeback of all time with Trenton. He crosses the Delaware and gets the Hessians on Christmas Day, and suddenly the momentum has been turned. And that winter, the Continental Congress, it's up to them to determine what major generals Washington will have, and it comes down to politics. And Arnold is from the state of Connecticut, which already has two major generals. And this means that Arnold, who is the highest-ranking brigadier general with bar none the best record, gets overlooked for promotion.
Mm.
This is deeply troubling to Washington, who doesn't know that Continental Congress has instituted a quota system, and he urges Arnold not to do anything rash. But this begins Arnold's turn in a dark direction because, you know, why am I doing this if I'm risking my life for a country that does not seem to appreciate what I'm doing.
Before we get to the story of Arnold's turn from American hero in the Revolutionary War to traitor, talk a little bit more about the role of Congress. I referred to it in the introduction of this conversation, how there are some similarities with how people feel about Congress these days being dysfunctional and full of self-serving politicians. So they were dealing with some of the same problems at that time, but it
Absolutely.
Was in the midst of trying to free themselves from Great Britain.
Right. And, you know, this meant that Washington, for example, all his energies could not be directed to defeating the British. He had to navigate a Continental Congress that was deeply suspicious of him. Because remember, in the history of the world, every previous rebellion in which a republic was the intended result had failed. And what would inevitably happen in the chaos following a revolution, the civil government would prove ineffective, and what would happen is the leader of the military forces would take over and become a dictator. It happened in Rome with Julius Caesar, in the English Civil War with Cromwell. Napoleon would do it after the French Revolution. And so the Continental Congress would, you know, maintain control over Washington for fear that this might be the ultimate result. And Washington, we now know, was a different kind of person. But you know, he was shackled by all this, and it created a truly dysfunctional situation. And Washington had the patience and resolves and endurance to keep plugging away, realizing that if we betray our commitment to civil government, we will betray the whole reason for this revolution. Arnold, on the other hand, became so frustrated with the dysfunctional nature of the civil government that he began to question the legitimacy of the revolution. That, you know, in the chaos that is resulting from all this, what are we fighting for? Is it, have we really betrayed the ideals which inspired this revolution? And so you see, it ultimately comes down to a study of character, how two very men that share some similarities ultimately follow very different paths.
If you've just joined us, my guest this half hour is Nathaniel Philbrick, New York Times bestselling author. Previous books include In the Heart of the Sea, National Book Award winner, as well as Mayflower. His latest book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. Let's get back to how Benedict Arnold evolved here and your more complex explanation of what turned him into a traitor. I mean, we have, compare what you found with what we have as a traditional narrative. We learned it in elementary school. I don't know if you're the same as I did, but Benedict Arnold was a traitor, and we didn't get very much past that as far as what made him a traitor and the circumstances he found himself in.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I mean, I you know, grew up thinking that Arnold was this kind of cardboard figure, this you know, the embodiment of absolute evil, and it didn't begin this way. He had his reasons for being disaffected, and you know, it was a complex thing. He was frustrated by being overlooked for promotion by Congress, and then about a year after his great performance at Valcour Island, at the Battle of Saratoga, which would ultimately be the victory that brought France into the revolution on our side, he would be treated terribly by his commanding officer Horatio Gates, who feared that Arnold would upstage him and knew exactly what buttons to push, because Arnold had served under him on Lake Champlain the previous year. Arnold is basically kicked out of the Northern Army at Saratoga before the climactic battle of the Battle of Bemis Heights, but that doesn't prevent him from appearing on the battlefield. You know, he's such a charismatic figure. Soldiers are willing to follow him anywhere. And he sees at the very end of the battle an opportunity at taking one of the British redoubts on the far right. He charges through two lines of fire as other American soldiers attack the redoubt from the front. He goes through the back in the rear entrance, the sally port, on his horse, waving a sword, orders the British soldiers to surrender. One of them lifts up his musket, fires. The musket ball punctures his left thigh, fracturing the thigh bone, going through his horse, killing it, that then collapses on top of Arnold's injured leg, and he's just lying there when an American officer comes up to him and says, "Are you badly hurt?" And he says, "I wish the musket ball had gone through my heart," because he realized they were going to win this thing. Gates was going to get the credit. He was going to be a cripple in the aftermath of all this. And this truly begins. I mean, you know, this mm-hmm. was a physical trauma. This was a psychic trauma that really began the downward spiral that would ultimately result in his turning traitor.
Okay, in the 5 or so minutes we have, Nathaniel, left of our conversation, fast forward to sort of the conclusion of your book when Benedict Arnold flees to the British, a nutshell story of that end, the traitorous end.
Yeah, well, by this time he's been in secret correspondence with the British for a year, and he is command of West Point, the preeminent fortress in America on the Hudson, and he has been in talks with Major John Andre, who the British spy chief, whom Arnold's new wife, the much younger Peggy Shippen, had gotten to know during the British occupation of Philadelphia. And Arnold has a midnight meeting with John Andre on the banks of the Hudson. I mean, you can't make this stuff up. In which Arnold gives him documents related to the best way to take the fortress. Arnold, there are 3,000 soldiers in the fortress, full of ammunition and provisions. The war is going terribly from the American perspective. If America loses West Point, this could be the end of it. And they have this midnight meeting. Andre is supposed to go down the Hudson to New York, where the soldiers have already been loaded into the ships. But the ship which is going to take him, the Vulture, is fired upon by an American officer, forces it down. Andre is forced to make his way by land. He's captured. They learn of his betrayal. And Arnold is forced to flee from his headquarters about a mile below West Point into New York, where Washington is just arrives at his headquarters for a meeting. Washington learns of all this, turns to Lafayette, the young French officer who's become a surrogate son, and says, "Whom can we trust now?" Washington took this deeply personally. I mean, he had forwarded Arnold's career from the beginning, and this man, one of his best generals, had betrayed not only him but every single American, and this was the wake up call for America. You know, our greatest enemy is not Great Britain, but it is from within. Mm. And I think there's no accident that within a year would come the great victory at Yorktown, because Arnold as a traitor did much to alert the American people to that the war was theirs to lose.
Would you point to that as one of the lessons from this narrative of our early history?
I think most of us think of Arnold as a traitor and a bad guy, but I think it's almost just more disturbing to realize that, you know, we might not have become a independent country without Arnold's treason.
How so?
Without that wake-up call, we might not have thrown it together, because the British then send Arnold to Virginia, where he turns the tidewater of Virginia is on fire. Governor Jefferson is sent running. Arnold is Washington in anger sends down Lafayette, and thus begins the movement of troops that will, in just a few months, bring on the great victory at Yorktown. And so, Arnold has a central place in the story, not only of the Revolution, but I think of America. You know, we have Washington the great hero, Washington, and Arnold is the great villain, and you need a hero and a villain to have a mythology of origins.
Uh-huh. And is that why this developed? We needed a simpler villain versus hero narrative instead of what you uncovered here, a much more complex character in Arnold.
Right, because it's a disturbing truth to think that Arnold wasn't a villain from the beginning, that he had his reasons, that to his own mind, his turning traitor was an act of protest. It wasn't an act of treason. This is a more complex, nuanced, and ultimately troubling account. And I think it's an important one for a country. You know, every generation is in the midst of its own revolution in this country. I mean, that's the nature of America. It's our great strength and our great challenge. And, there are versions of Arnold in every generation, where self-interest masquerades as patriotism. And, we will always have to be alert to the threat that is there's not only outside, but it's within. And it, you know, speaks to the character of this nation and the country that sprang from a revolution.
Nathaniel Philbrick, thank you for your time with us. New book, this is a fascinating read, also a good summer read if you're looking for one of those. George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution, written by Nathaniel Philbrick. And we've enjoyed talking with you about valiant ambition. Nathaniel, thanks so much.
Well, it's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
And that does it for this edition of River to River. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.